This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Wynn Stevenson, independent journalist, climate activist, and a contributing editor for The Nation. A former editor at The Atlantic and Boston Globe, he was most recently the senior producer of NPR's On Point. His writing on climate, culture, and politics has also appeared in Slate, The New York Times, Grist, and The Boston Phoenix. Wynn Stevenson is here today to tell us about his book, What We're Fighting For Now Is Each Other, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Climate Justice, published in 2015. Welcome, Wynn.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thank you.
What is the purpose of your book, What We're Fighting For Now Is Each Other?
I guess the purpose of this book is to tell the stories of people. It's really a book about people who are coming to terms with the climate crisis, or what I call the climate catastrophe, really. You know, it's about people who have come to terms with it and then taken action, in some cases, some pretty dramatic actions that, you know, might appear extreme or radical to some people. But when you really step back and look at the situation that we're facing, there are actions that actually kind of make sense.
What do you mean by what we're fighting for now is each other?
So really, the subtitle of the book is important to explaining that. You know, it's called Dispatches from the Front Lines of Climate Justice. And it has to do with the fact that climate change is fundamentally an issue of justice now, that it is, if anything, the greatest human rights and social justice struggle that humanity faces at this point, and you almost want to say has ever faced, although of course there have been many deeply important, urgent human rights struggles throughout history, some of which I write about as sources of inspiration for what we're facing today. But yeah, it's the idea that now, given what we're facing, given the inevitability of a great deal of very disruptive climate change that's heading our way, and the sheer urgency of getting a handle on the kind of really radical deep emissions reductions that we need, you know, this is now a struggle for humanity. And at this point, if you ask what it is that we're really fighting for, at this point, we are fighting somehow to hold on to our humanity, to get through what we now know is coming, kind of with our humanity intact. So this idea that in many ways our struggles for social justice and human rights are now more important than ever, given what we're facing. And therefore, this is a fight about more than just keeping carbon in the ground. It's actually a fight for holding on to our humanity as we go forward into this very difficult century that we're facing.
Would you speak about your own journey toward climate activism?
Sure. So I spent better part of two decades as a journalist, as an editor and producer in mainstream media, places like The Atlantic and The Boston Globe, and working on NPR's On Point and so on. And it was in 2009 and 2010 that I really kind of woke up to what it is we're facing. And believe me, I understand, as I say in the book, this was a belated awakening, obviously, as it has been and is now for so many people. Many of the people I write about in the book have been working on this now for two or even three decades. But in some ways, I'm typical in that my waking up to this crisis has come quite late. And it's that lateness, the lateness of the hour, that really hovers over and runs through this whole book and this whole discussion, because I think it is absolutely central to grappling honestly with what we're now facing. So it was in 2009. I was still the senior producer at NPR's On Point, and I was following very closely the Copenhagen conference, the UN conference in Copenhagen in late 2009. And when that fell apart, it was pretty shocking to a lot of people. And it was at that same time that I was getting ready to leave that job. I decided to move on and actually go back to writing again. And so in the spring of 2010, just after leaving, I was looking around for what to do next, you know, what to focus on. And that was really when things kind of hit the fan in terms of climate change, really. We not only had the collapse at Copenhagen, but we also had what was now clearly going to be the failure of any sort of comprehensive climate legislation in the U.S. Congress, and it was quite clear that Barack Obama was not going to lead on this issue the way many people had hoped. So for me, it was coming to grips with both the scientific reality on the one hand of what it is we're really facing, the sheer urgency and scale of it, and then the political reality on the other hand. The fact that our political system that we have just simply has failed and is failing to really deal with this in any adequate way. And it was at that same moment, it was kind of a turning point, I think, for climate politics and certainly for the environmental movement and what has become really the truth climate movement, that people realize if we're actually going to deal with this, we're going to have to get serious about actually building a movement, a real social movement, grassroots, bottom-up social movement. And so, yeah, it was at that time, spring and summer of 2010, that I decided I really couldn't imagine waking up in the morning and working on anything else, and I decided to start writing about it and also to engage as an activist. I just felt like writing for mainstream media wasn't going to be enough, and I made a deliberate decision at that point to basically walk away from my mainstream media career because I knew that once I started engaging as an activist, I wouldn't be going back to places like the Boston Globe and NPR.
In your book, you say that the climate struggle is a spiritual struggle. Would you explain?
So as I was just saying, you know, there about getting serious about building a movement, when you look at history, the kind of truly transformative social movements that have actually changed the course of history, whether it was the abolitionist movement, early on in the book I focus on the abolitionist movement, you know, these movements required a kind of commitment and a kind of willingness to sacrifice that you have to ask, where does that come from? And what I've found, both in my own experience and in many of the people that I write about and interviewed and profile in this book, is that this moment and the kind of struggle that we're talking about here is really a deeply spiritual struggle. There's a kind of spiritual crisis, as I say, at the heart of the climate crisis, because it really forces us to ask some of the most difficult questions about ourselves and about our society and what is now required. So what I found is that so many of the people who are really committed to working on climate and really committed to building this movement, and not only the folks who have engaged in bold acts of nonviolent direct action and so on, but I'm talking about people who've really committed their lives to this. So many of them have been through this kind of spiritual struggle. When I say spiritual, I don't necessarily mean religious in the traditional sense, although for many people it is, and for me it kind of has been. But by spiritual, I just kind of mean deeply human, you know, really grappling with these most difficult questions about ourselves. And so when you do look back at history, so many of these transformative movements have come from this kind of a place. The abolitionist movement, the civil rights movement, the mid-century peace movement, you know, examples of really transformative movements where the people driving them have really come from this kind of spiritual place. So, yeah, I kind of draw an analogy there, but it's also just based on my working alongside of people and getting to know people in this movement and trying to understand who they are and where they're really coming from and what really drives them.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Wynn Stevenson, author of the book What We're Fighting For Now Is Each Other, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Climate Justice. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. In your book, you speak about climate justice as key in addressing climate change. First, what is your definition of climate justice?
There are various definitions, and actually one of the things I try to do in the book, you know, one of the questions I'm asking throughout the book is what exactly does climate justice even mean now? At this late date, and at this late hour of the climate struggle. Classically speaking, the term climate justice, or the idea behind it, has been around about as long as our understanding of climate change has been around. And it's the recognition that those who have done the least, you know, little or nothing, to actually cause this crisis, those who are the least historically responsible, in this case the poorest and most vulnerable people on the planet, and mostly in developing nations, they're the ones who are already, in many cases, and are certainly going to suffer the most from this. And so, therefore, those who are the most historically responsible, the wealthier industrialized nations, have a responsibility to step up and bear the lion's share of the burden for dealing with it. And that means not only making far deeper and more rapid emissions cuts than really anything that's currently on the table, but it also means assisting poor countries, the most vulnerable countries, in making the most rapid transition to clean energy as possible, and also helping them prepare for the climate change that is already on the way. So that, at a very basic level, the global level, that's always what kind of what climate justice has meant in terms of the international negotiations. But climate justice is scalable from that global level down to the local level. And here, even in our own country, we can talk about climate justice because this idea of a just transition from fossil fuels to clean energy applies very much here at home. When we look at the poorest and hardest hit communities here in the United States, this just seems like a basic matter of fairness and justice that we not try to solve this thing on the backs of the people who have done the least to cause the situation and can least afford it, right? And in many cases, the very same people who are really on the front lines of not only the impacts of climate change, but have been for decades on the front lines of the pollution caused by the fossil fuel industry, whether extraction and refining and everything. So we know, it's well documented, the environmental justice movement in this country has been fighting for decades to recognize and address the fact that the fossil fuel industry and its pollution is disproportionately affecting poor communities, and especially communities of color. So climate justice here in the United States has much to do with racial and economic justice. And I think leading with that, putting that up front as we address this, as we frame this issue, can go a long way toward broadening this movement to really turning it into creating the kind of broad-based social movement that we need. And we've begun to even see that now, I think. It's starting to happen in a way that it really hadn't before. We've seen it with the People's Climate Movement, the People's Climate March last year in September, and the organizing that went into that and has come out of that. There are many more stronger alliances and coalition building basically going on now that wasn't happening before.
What groups in the U.S. are promoting climate justice, and what issues are they taking on?
A good many. You know, as I say there at the outset, you know, the climate justice movement in this country is quite broad and diverse. So it would include everything from groups like 350.org, a broad national and even global network, and Rising Tide North America, which is a network of grassroots folks working to apply a more radical analysis to the climate crisis and address some of these deeper issues of social justice, racial justice, and economic justice I was talking about. And then it also includes a great many local and regional grassroots groups, and quite a few of whom have kind of banded together over the last couple of years into what's now called the Climate Justice Alliance. And so that would include a whole array of groups, some of which are national networks and others are local and regional groups. I write about some in the book, for example, the Black Mesa Water Coalition on the Navajo lands in northern Arizona and their work to shut down coal plants and to launch a major industrial-scale solar facility. And it includes urban groups from New York to the Bay Area to Houston, all over the place, fighting for environmental and economic justice in those places. So it's pretty exciting. I think they're making some real progress. And again, it's injecting into this movement a much greater sense of the kind of intersectionality of this issue, the fact that it's about far more than just keeping carbon in the ground. Although that keeping carbon in the ground is absolutely essential.
Let's focus on some of the individuals you highlight in your book, their actions and what led them to engage in civil disobedience to address climate change. Let's start with Tim DeChristopher. Remind us of his actions to disrupt an auction of oil and gas drilling leases.
So Tim DeChristopher plays a big role in this book, partly because he was really the first person who really kind of woke me up to the true dimensions of what we're facing and the kind of commitment that it will require to really address it, you know, to build the kind of movement that we need. So Tim DeChristopher, in 2008, when he was in his late 20s as an economics student at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, he had recently had his kind of own awakening to the climate crisis. And he found out about an upcoming auction, a Bureau of Land Management, BLM, auction of oil and gas drilling leases on public lands in southern Utah, in fact, near some of the pristine national parks like Canyonlands and Arches. And so he decided to join a protest of this auction. And when he got there, it was pretty tame. People were outside, you know, protesting. But he decided to try to get inside. He'd been preparing himself for taking some kind of bolder action, and he'd been studying social movement history and civil disobedience. And he went up to the entrance, and then they asked him if he was there for the auction, and he said, yes, I am. And then they asked him if he was there to be a bidder. And he said, yes, I am. And so they registered him, now famously, as bidder number 70, bidder 70. And he went in, and what he sees is shocking. He realizes that these large, these enormous parcels of public land are basically being given away, you know, sold for pennies to these oil and gas companies. And so at first he just starts raising his paddle and bidding up the prices a little bit, you know. And then he starts winning bids. He starts winning bids to a point where he's now won tens of thousands of acres worth almost $2 million that he can't possibly pay. So it's a classic case, really one of the most creative and now I think iconic acts of a kind of nonviolent resistance, you know, kind of monkey wrenching episode that anyone can remember. So he was arrested and he ended up being prosecuted to the hilt and spent almost 2 years in prison, in federal prison, for this act of conscience, even though it was later found that the auction shouldn't have gone forward in the first place, that the outgoing George W. Bush administration had cut corners and hadn't gone through with all the right environmental review process to conduct the auction, and the auction itself was invalidated. But Tim was still prosecuted and sent to prison. So Tim went on to become this very inspirational voice and figure and helped galvanize the climate movement, the climate justice movement. He sees himself as a climate justice activist. And that brings in an interesting other part of climate justice that I actually didn't mention before, which is that for Tim and so many others, young people, there is also a distinct generational aspect to climate justice. Not only is it the poorest and most vulnerable globally and in our own country, but young people, today's young people and children and, of course, future generations will suffer far disproportionate impacts of climate change, and they've done, again, little or nothing to cause it. So Tim, when he got out of prison, ended up going to Harvard Divinity School, which is near where I live. I live outside of Boston, and I actually have had a chance to get to know him and even to work with him a little bit on some things, and now he, together with some of the other activists I write about in the book, have launched something called the Climate Disobedience Center, climatedisobedience.org. which is intended to encourage and support other activists who find themselves ready to take some serious nonviolent direct action in the face of the climate crisis.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Wen Stevenson, author of the book What We're Fighting For Now Is Each Other, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Climate Justice. Would you tell us about the actions of Ken Ward and Jay O'Hara, who acted to prevent coal shipments to a coal-burning power plant in Massachusetts?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that's great, because they're actually the others who Tim has joined together with to found the Climate Disobedience Center. So Ken Ward and Jay O'Hara are friends of mine, activists here in Massachusetts. Ken is in his 50s, and he actually lives in the Pacific Northwest now, come to think of it. And he's a longtime environmentalist. In fact, at one point, he spent a few years as the deputy director of Greenpeace USA. And then Jay is younger. He's in his early 30s. He's a young Quaker activist, actually, and grew up on Cape Cod. And Ken and Jay both became greatly disillusioned with the environmental movement and really what they see, and a lot of others as well, see as the failure to really deal with the climate crisis with their necessary urgency. And so in 2013, they decided that they were going to take more dramatic action themselves. And they anchored a 30-some-odd-foot lobster boat, which they named the Henry David T. They anchored it in the path of a 680-some-odd-foot coal freighter carrying 40,000 tons of West Virginia coal to the Brayton Point Power Station in Somerset, Massachusetts, in order to block the delivery of that coal to that coal-fired power plant, at least for a day, which they succeeded in doing. And they risked going to prison for that. But what ended up happening was they went to trial, and they were the first climate activists in this country to be allowed to go forward with a necessity defense in their trial. a necessity defense, you know, arguing that their actions were justified given the circumstances. But what happened was the prosecutor in Fall River, Massachusetts, you know, last year in September of 2014 when they actually went to trial, prosecutor, the DA, actually ended up dropping the charges and then going out and making a statement supporting them, saying that the climate crisis is, you know, the greatest crisis we've ever faced and that the political leadership on it has been gravely lacking and that what Ken and Jay did was an act of civil disobedience and that they should be treated leniently. And then he announced that he was going to go down and march with them in the People's Climate March 2 weeks later. So that was a pretty interesting turn of events, and as I note, a small victory in the scale of things, but nevertheless, indicative of something. Something is happening.
Overall, to what extent have the actions of civil disobedience taken by the individuals you speak about in your book made a difference?
Yeah, well, I mean, just right there with Ken and Jay, I think it's clear that they have touched people. So, you know, they have changed some minds and some hearts. And I think that that is primarily what these acts of civil disobedience do, you know. They dramatize the situation. You know, they say to our leaders and to everyone, you know, look, if this is what it's come to, if I have to put my body in the way of a 40,000-ton shipment of coal in order to get your attention and dramatize what needs to be done, then so be it. And when you think about it, you know, that is the job of the climate movement at this point. Not so much to propose specific policies that will fit within the very narrow parameters of our current politics, but rather to tell the truth about the situation, no matter how extreme it sounds, and to say that even the outermost limits of what is politically possible right now on climate change isn't enough, and that therefore we have to radically expand those limits. We have to radically change our politics. And so, you know, historically, the only times we've ever actually seen the kind of deep revolutionary change that we need right now is when ideas and principles and demand that once seemed truly radical and outside the mainstream, whether it was the abolition of slavery or the right of women to vote, is when those things have been forced into the mainstream conversation, when radical social movements have forced the issue. And that is what we're beginning to see now, I think. And I think we're beginning to see things move just a bit. Not enough. We still have a lot of work to do. But something is happening.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I guess the message I'd like to leave you with is that it actually does matter very much what we do now. All the time we hear people asking, well, isn't it too late? You know, isn't the science at this point telling us that there's nothing much we can do at this point to head off catastrophic climate change? And to some extent, yes, that is true. And yet, at the same time, we have to ask ourselves, is it ever really too late? Because what do you mean by that? Too late for what? And so for me and for a lot of people I know, the lateness of the hour only adds to the urgency of our fights for social justice and for addressing this in a way that will actually maintain our humanity. It'll never be too late to fight for one another as we head into this very, very difficult future.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Wen.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You are just listening to Wen Stevenson, author of the book What We're Fighting For Now Is Each Other, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Climate Justice, published in 2015 by Beacon Press. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Power at 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on KEXP.org.